Laurent Group air crews in planes flying under the shells to infiltrate the kill squads and their weapons onto the continent. It will be expensive, but Marc Laurent has instructed me to succeed by any means necessary. Regal's connections to the upper levels of the company couldn't be denied, but Lloyd's political instincts demanded that he reassert his position. I remain in charge of the operation. I will coordinate the movements of the watchers and the shooters. You just get me this manpower.
Agreed. I'll arrange our little contest, get everyone on station. But I will let you guide the teams. Keep me posted on the progress, and don't hesitate to seek out my counsel. I am a hunter, Lloyd. Hunting the Gray Man on the streets of Europe will be the greatest expedition of my career.
He paused.
I just wish you didn't fuck with Fitzroy.
Leave him to me.
Oh, I have every intention of doing just that. Sir Donald and his family are your problem, not mine.
No problem at all.
Chapter 9. Gentry allowed himself to admit that his fortunes seemed to be changing. After limping northward towards the Turkish border for less than an hour, he was picked up by a patrol of local Kurdish police. The Kurds in northern Iraq love Americans, especially American soldiers, and from his tattered uniform and injuries, they presumed him to be an American Special Forces operator. Court did nothing to dissuade them of this assumption. They drove him into Mosul and cleaned him up and rebandaged his leg wound in a clinic built by the U.S. government. Within 7 hours of dropping from the ass of an airplane without a parachute on his back, the American assassin found himself dressed in pressed slacks and a linen shirt, boarding a commercial aircraft bound for Tbilisi, Georgia. The improvement in his circumstances was not due entirely to luck. One of Court's fallback plans involved him finding his own way out of Iraq, and to prepare himself for this eventuality, he'd sewn a forged passport, forged visas for Georgia and Turkey, cash, and other necessary documents into the legs of his pants. No, Gentry benefited from a little luck from time to time, but he did not rely on it. He was nothing if not a man prepared. After passing through Georgian customs with a Canadian passport identifying himself as Martin Baldwin, freelance journalist, he bought a ticket to Prague, Czech Republic. The 5-hour flight was nearly empty, and Court landed at Ruzhny Airport just after 10 in the evening. He knew Prague like the back of his hand. He'd worked a job here once and often used the neighboring suburbs as a place to hide out. After a cab and a metro ride, he walked through the cobblestone streets of the Staromesto district, then checked into a tiny attic hotel room a quarter mile from the Vltava River. After a long, soaking shower, he had just sat down to redress his thigh when the satellite phone in his new backpack began to beep. Court checked it, saw that Fitzroy was calling, and continued to work on the gunshot wound. He'd talk to Don in the morning. Gentry was understandably pissed about the extraction team turning on him. He didn't even entertain the possibility that Sir Donald himself had ordered his men to kill him. No, he was angry because Fitzroy's operation was obviously compromised to the degree that the Nigerians were able to infiltrate a mission in progress and almost succeed in turning his rescuers into his executioners. Fitzroy had been strongly against Court going through with the hit on Abu Bakr after the death of the paymaster, and now Gentry wondered if Fitzroy had put together a half-assed support structure for the op as a way to show his disapproval. Fitzroy's organized support structure was called the Network, and the Network was Gentry's only lifeline in the field. It was made up of legitimate doctors who would patch up a wounded man, no questions asked. Legitimate cargo pilots who would take a stowaway on board without looking over the gear on his back. Legitimate printers who could alter documents. The list went on and on, grew over time. Gentry used the Network as little as possible, much less than the other men in Fitzroy's stable. The Gray Man was, after all, a high-speed, low-drag operator. But everyone who works in Gentry's arduous profession needs a little help from time to time, and Court was no different. Gentry had worked for Fitzroy for 4 years, beginning within a few months of the night the CIA indicated that they no longer required the services of their most experienced and successful manhunter. Court thought back to the night. The indication of their dissatisfaction was followed immediately by a bomb in his car, a hit squad in his apartment, and an international arrest warrant processed from the Justice Department, distributed through Interpol to every law enforcement agency on the planet. At that time, Gentry was desperate for work to fund his life in hiding from the U.S. government, so he contacted Sir Donald Fitzroy. The Englishman ran a seemingly above-board security business, but Gentry had had dealings with the black side of Cheltenham Security Services when performing hits and renditions with the CIA's Special Activities Division, so it was a natural place for the recently unemployed gunman to seek work. Since then, he had become something of a star in the world of private operators. Although virtually no one knew his real name, or the fact that he worked for Fitzroy, the Grey Man had become a legend amongst covert operators across the Western world. As with any legend, many of the details were enhanced, enriched, or wholly fabricated. One of the details of the myth of the Grey Man that was true, however, was his personal ethic to only accept contracts against targets that he felt had earned the punishment of extrajudicial execution. This was entirely novel in the world of killers for hire, and though it enhanced his reputation, it also caused him to be extremely choosy about his operations. Gentry took the toughest of the tough ops, went into bandit country alone, faced legions of enemies, and built a reputation and a bank account that was unrivaled in his admittedly low-profile industry. In 4 years, he had satisfactorily performed 12 operations against terrorists and terrorist paymasters, white slavery profiteers, drug and illegal weapons runners, and Russian mafia kingpins. Rumor had it he'd already made more money than he could ever need, so the inference was that he did what he did for the purpose of righting wrongs, protecting the weak, making the world a better place through the muzzle of his gun. The myth was a fantasy, not reality. But unlike most fantasies, the man at the center of this one did exist. His motivations were complex, not the comic book stimuli that had been ascribed to him, but at his core, he did consider himself one of the good guys. No, he didn't need the money, nor did he have a death wish. Court Gentry was the Grey Man simply because he believed there existed bad men in this world who truly needed to die. Lloyd and his two Northern Irish henchmen put Fitzroy into a Laurent Group limousine and motored through the city in a driving rain. There was no conversation. Fitzroy sat quietly, holding his hat in his hands between his knees, looking out the window into the rainy night like a beaten man. Lloyd worked his mobile phone, making and taking call after call, constantly checking in with Regal, who was contacting men all over the globe to set their rushed plan into motion. The limo arrived at Laurent Group's UK subsidiary just after 1 a.m. The French corporation's local office was housed in a 3-building campus in Fulham. Lloyd, his men, and their cargo rolled through the front gates, past 2 rings of guards and guns, and down a road towards a single-story structure alongside a helipad.
"This will be home for a while, Sir Donald. I apologize if it's not up to the standards of that to which you are accustomed, but at least you won't go wanting for company. My men and I will not leave your side until we get everything settled and we can take you back to Bayswater Road and put you right back where we found you with a pat on your bald head."
Fitzroy said nothing. He followed the entourage through the rain into the building and down a long hallway. He passed 2 more men in suits standing in a little kitchen, and he immediately identified them as plainclothed security officers. For a moment, Fitzroy had a flicker of hope, and it showed on his face. Lloyd read his thoughts.
"Sorry, Sir Donald. These are not your boys. A couple of heavies from our Edinburgh office. These Scotsmen hold allegiance to me, not you."
Fitzroy continued down the hall.
he mumbled. I know 1,000 chaps like that. Those blokes hold no allegiance. They're in it for the money, and they will turn on you if the price is right.
Lloyd waved a card key over a reader alongside the last door in the hall.
Well then, lucky for me I pay so well.
It was a large conference room, with an oak table and high-backed chairs, the walls lined with flat-screen monitors, computers, and a big LCD display showing a map of Western Europe.
Lloyd said, "Why don't you take the head of the table? Considering your knighthood, I apologize we couldn't arrange something round for you. I'm afraid oval was the best we could manage."
The American chuckled at his own joke. The two Scottish security men took places near the door, and the Northern Irishman found corners in which to stand. A thin black man in a chestnut-brown suit entered and sat at the table with a bottle of water in front of him.
"Mr. Felix works for President Abu Bakr," Lloyd explained. It was far short of an introduction. "He's here to verify we killed the gray man."
Mr. Felix nodded to Fitzroy from across the table. Lloyd conferred with a young man with a ponytail and a nose ring, whose thickly rimmed glasses reflected the light from the computers on the desk in front of him. He looked up to Lloyd and whispered. Lloyd turned to Sir Donald.
"Everything is on schedule. This man will be in charge of all communication between the Watchers, the Hunters, and myself. We will call him the Tech."
The young man stood and proffered a hand politely, as if he had no idea he was being introduced to a kidnapping victim. Fitzroy turned away. Just then, the Tech took a call in his headset. He spoke softly to Lloyd in a British accent. Lloyd replied,
"Perfect. Get assets there immediately. Pin down his location."
Lloyd smiled at Fitzroy.
"It was time I had a little luck. Gentry was spotted in Tbilisi, boarding a plane to Prague. The flight has already landed, so we can't tail him from the airport, but we have men checking the hotels. Hopefully, we'll have a hit team there waiting for him when he gets up in the morning."
An hour later, Lloyd sat at the table opposite Fitzroy. The lights were dimmed, and the Tech placed a backlight behind the American. A camera on the ceiling spun under motor power to face him. A monitor displayed a silhouette of Lloyd, so obscured that the young attorney had to lift his arm in the air in a wave to be sure he was looking at himself in real time. Next, one by one, LCD screens along the wall across the table came to life. At the bottom of each screen were a title and the local time. Luanda, Botswana was first online. Four men sat in a conference room similar to the one in England. They were backlit and in silhouette, similar to Lloyd. Then Jakarta, Indonesia came up. This time, there were six dark figures sitting shoulder to shoulder at a table and looking at a monitor. Then Tripoli, Libya. A minute later, Caracas, Venezuela. Pretoria, South Africa. And Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, all illuminated simultaneously. Within the next 5 minutes, the feeds from Albania, Sri Lanka, Kazakhstan and Bolivia were up and running. Freetown, Liberia took another minute for the Tech to patch through. Finally, the transmission from South Korea appeared. A single Asian man sat alone at a desk. These were the government kill teams Kurt Riegel had arranged for the hunt. Riegel had already spoken to the head of each team's agency, so he declined speaking to the operators directly. That was Lloyd's job. As Riegel had said, he was just helping with arrangements and consultation. Before the audio came online, Lloyd called across the room to the Tech.
"Where are the rest of the Koreans?"
The Tech checked a paper on his desk quickly.
"They just sent one guy. Don't guess it will matter. All in all, there are over 50 men total on the 12 teams."
The Tech next assured Lloyd his voice would be altered with both hardware and software to make it completely unrecognizable. After a final moment for the Tech to check the audio link with the translators sitting off-camera in each location that needed them, Lloyd cleared his throat. His silhouette brought a hand to his mouth and then lowered it.
"Gentlemen, I know you have been briefed in general about the mission we have for you. It's very simple, really. I need a man found, but that is not your problem. I have nearly 100 pavement artists either on call or already on the job combing the area of operations at this very moment. Once found, I will need this man neutralized. This will be your objective.
The image in the monitors at the 12 remote locations changed. A color photo of a clean-shaven court gentry in a sport coat and wire-rimmed glasses appeared on the screen. Lloyd had taken it from a forged passport in his CIA file.
This is the gray man, court gentry. The photograph before you is 5 years old. I am afraid I do not know how he might have changed his appearance. Don't let his normalcy fool you. He was the best scalp hunter who ever worked for the CIA.
Someone mumbled something in Spanish. Lloyd understood only one word. Milosevic.
Yes, I thought some of you may already know this man by his reputation. Rumors abound regarding his operations. Some say he killed Milosevic. Some say he did not. Some say he was responsible for the events in Kiev last year. Most reasonable minds recognize that to be impossible. Nevertheless, I know enough about specific jobs that he has carried out, both working for the U.S. government as well as his private work, to assure you Mr. Gentry is the most formidable singleton operator you will ever encounter.
A new disembodied voice spoke. Looks like a faggot.
From the accent, Lloyd immediately turned his attention to the South African feed. Lloyd's altered voice reverberated through the speakers.
He will be the faggot who walks right up to you and slips an ice pick between your ribs, pops your lung, and stands above you while you choke to death on your own blood.
There was anger in the American lawyer's voice.
You kill him, and then you can tell me what a fucking joke he is. Until you kill him, you keep your goddamn juvenile comments to yourself.
The South African feed fell silent. Lloyd continued, still glaring at the silhouettes in Pretoria.
The gray man is trained in long-distance sniping, in close-quarters battle, in edged weapons, Krav Maga, the martial art used by Israeli special forces. He can kill with a long gun, a short gun, or no gun at all. He can take you out from a mile away, or you can die with his breath in your ear. He has extensive training in explosive ordnance and even poisons. There was a rumor going around the CIA that once in Lahore, Pakistan, he used a blowgun to take down a target in a restaurant while he went unnoticed by the target security detail.
Lloyd paused for effect. Gentry was at the next table, kept right on eating his meal as the target dropped dead. As soon as we finish here, you will all board aircraft. We will send a dozen teams in a dozen planes to a dozen airports along the route we expect Gentry to take across Europe in the next 48 hours. I will oversee and coordinate the activities from here, and I will pass on any intelligence I may be able to obtain. Each team that takes part in the hunt and survives will be paid $1 million plus any expenses incurred. The team that kills Gentry will be paid a bonus of $20 million.
"What's America going to do if we kill him?"
asked a man with a booming African voice. Lloyd turned to the Liberian feed, but he was not certain.
"This has been addressed by the leaders of your organizations. This man is already marked for death by the U.S. government. There is shoot-on-sight sanction at the CIA. He has no friends, no close family. No one on this earth will cry for him when he dies."
Next, someone spoke in an Asian language. When he finished, a translator asked,
"Where is he now?"
"He flew to Prague last night. I have our agents asking around at hotels for him, but there is no way to know if he is still there."
"Which team is being sent to Prague?"
someone asked. "The Albanians. They are closest."
"That's hardly fair," shouted a South African.
Lloyd, in silhouette, took off his glasses and rubbed the bridge of his nose.
"No offense to the Albanians, but I don't think the first team he encounters will be the one that gets him."
There was grumbling on the Albanian feed, but it was quickly extinguished with hisses.
"We will kill Gentry in the next 2 days, yes, but we will likely do it through attrition. Many of you may die."
He paused a beat, a half-hearted attempt to act like he gave a shit.
That said, we don't know that the Albanians will get the first crack at him. He may well have moved west by the time your plane lands. If that is the case, if we do pick up his trail past Prague, we will put you back on your plane, and you will take up a new ambush point closer to the final destination. There is no clear advantage to being farthest east, I assure everyone.
Lloyd sat up straighter in his chair. His silhouette appeared thin but athletic.
Let me finish by saying this. Do what it takes to get the job done. I could not possibly care less about collateral damage. If you can't stomach a few dead kids or dead pensioners or dead puppy dogs, then don't get on my goddamn airplane. Your job is to kill Court Gentry. Do that, and you will make millions for your organization and garner the thanks of the Central Intelligence Agency. Fail, and you will most likely die by his hand. You would be well served to avoid worrying about anything else. Any questions?
There were none.
Then, gentlemen, game on.
At 4:15 in the morning, a Laurent Group security officer from the firm's massive truck farm in Brno, Czech Republic, showed Gentry's photo to a sleepy hotel desk clerk at a narrow four-story inn in the Staré Město, the old town of Prague. The old man behind the hotel counter looked at the photo for a long time, said he could not be sure, but upon taking payment of 500 crowns from the beady-eyed stranger, he changed his tone. He was certain the clean-shaven man in the picture and the bearded tourist in his attic room were one and the same. The surveillance agent called Lloyd immediately. He was an employee of Laurent Group, and Lloyd was under strict orders to keep company people away from any direct action, so Lloyd instructed him to go home.
"A team is on the way," Lloyd said.
"If you meet him dead, I'll do it for 100,000 crowns.
Lloyd chuckled into the phone.
"No, you won't."
"Are you saying I can't handle?"
"Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying."
"Fucking American prick."
"I'm the fucking American prick who just saved your worthless Czech life. Go home. Forget. You will receive a bonus for your good work."
"I hate Americans."
Lloyd laughed out loud as the line went dead. Chapter 10. Gentry awoke at 5 in the morning. The bullet wound in his thigh stung and throbbed. It had been anything but a good night's rest. He sat up slowly and painfully, leaned forward to stretch his lower back and hamstrings, stood, and tilted hard to each side. He wanted to spend the day moving. He had not yet decided on a destination, but he knew the sooner he left the hotel, the better. After a quick trip to the bathroom to relieve himself and check the dressing on his leg, he dressed in the same clothing as the night before. He then looked out the window for signs of surveillance. Finding nothing amiss, he descended the stairs and left the building at 25 minutes past the hour. He had created a mental to-do list for the day. 1, go to his local cashier in Prague and retrieve a small handgun. He would not be doing any more flying. The plane trips of the last 24 hours were an anomaly in his life, because Court hated to be unarmed. He only boarded commercial aircraft as a last resort, had flown no more than a dozen times in the past 4 years. Now, as he walked unarmed through the darkened and deserted cobblestone streets of Prague, he felt naked. The only consolation to his martial needs was a small Spyderco folding knife in his waistband that he'd bought off a Kurdish policeman. It was better than nothing, but inferior to any sort of firearm. After hitting his cash, he'd need to get out of town, pay cash for a cheap motorcycle, and just buzz on out of Prague. Maybe spend a week or so moving from village to village in the Czech Republic or Slovakia. He hoped this would keep him safe until the Nigerian president left office and, hopefully, left him in peace. No one could disappear more quickly or cleanly than the 36-year-old American. As Court walked towards the subway, he decided to place one more important item at the front of his to-do list. He smelled fresh coffee wafting from a little cafe just opening. And at that moment, he felt he needed coffee as much as he needed a gun. He was wrong. A dense fog filled the dark street in front of the cafe, and it began to rain just as Cord climbed up a pair of steps and entered the tiny eatery. It was just 5:30. He had the impression he was the first customer of the day. Cort knew enough Czech to extend a greeting to the young girl behind the counter. He pointed to a steaming urn of coffee and a large pastry, watched the pale-skinned girl pour a foam cup full of rich black brew and place his breakfast in a bag. Just then, the doorbell dinged behind him. He glanced back to see three men enter, close umbrellas, and shake fresh rain from their coats. They looked local, but Cort could not be sure. The first man glanced up at him as Gentry took his purchases over to a tiny stand with milk and sugar to dress his coffee. Cort looked at a glass-covered flyer promoting a poetry reading that hung on the wall, gazed idly at the window at his right, towards the dark and rainy street. A few seconds later, he was out in the elements, ignoring the cold morning shower and walking towards the metro station at Mustek. There were no other pedestrians around. The cold and the rain and the early hour saw to that. Cort did not mind the frigid air. He appreciated its ability to inject life into his tired muscles and still fatigued brain. A few delivery trucks were about, and Gentry looked into the wet windshields of each as they passed. He found the entrance to the metro and descended the steep stairs. His still tired eyes adjusted slowly to the harsh electric lighting around him, the cold, white tile reflecting the illumination from above. He followed signs down a winding tunnel towards the trains. Another escalator took him deeper below the sleepy city, and another turn took him even farther into the brightly lit bowels of the metro station. Shortly before a right turn in the passage, he passed a garbage can. In it, he dropped his untouched coffee and his bag of pastry. Then he made the right turn, took two more steps, and stopped. He flexed his muscles quickly, his arms, back, legs, neck, even his jaw tensed. Then he reached into his waistband for his folding knife. He retrieved it and flicked it open, the maneuver executed in an impossible blur of speed and proficiency. He spun around, took a single step back the way he came, leapt into the air to cover as much ground as quickly as possible, and plunged the 3-inch blade hilt deep into the throat of the first man following him. The man was thick and hard and tall and broad. His meaty right hand grasped a stainless steel automatic pistol. Gentry grabbed the wrist of the gun hand and held the muzzle down and away, lest the dying man's spasms cause the weapon to fire. Cort took no time to look into the square-jawed man's eyes. Had he done so, he would have seen shock and confusion long before the onset of panic or pain. Instead, the gray man pushed the man backwards to the tunnel's corner, slammed him into the second would-be assassin, and caught this man as he was rounding the turn and pulling his gun. Cort held the knife's grip with his right hand. It was still stuck in the first man's throat, and he used it to push the first into the second, used his other hand now to fight for the handgun in the first's dying grip. The gun would not come free. Cort could now see the third man behind the second's falling form, and the third's gun was rising to fire. Gentry ducked his head into the chest of the man with the knife sunk into his throat, pushed forward over the goon falling back to the floor, and advanced quickly towards the last in line. An ear-splitting gunshot rocked the tiled tunnel. The cacophonous explosion amplified by the low ceiling and narrow corridor. Gentry felt the bullet slam into the back of the bloody man in his arms. A second round barked and punched into Cort's dance partner. Still, the American pushed the man backwards, finally shoving him as hard as possible. As the operator's bloody body was flung at the third man, Gentry pulled his knife out of the throat and made a final reach for the pistol in the beefy right hand. He managed to hold on to the knife, but the corpse slammed into the third operator with his dead hand still firmly clutching the gun. Now Gentry stood between two living assassins, both armed, each less than 10 feet from him. Behind Cort was the armed man on the ground. Surely by now he was rolling around to get a shot off. And in front of Cort was the standing man, now shoving his blood-spewing partner out of his way to recite his weapon on his target. Court flicked his knife so that he was holding the blade and quickly threw it overhand at the standing gunman. The blade struck perfectly, buried itself in the man's left eye socket. Blood erupted, and the operator dropped his gun to bring both hands to the knife. He fell to his knees. Gentry did not look to the threat behind him. Instead, he drove forward, both arms outstretched, desperate to get his hands on a firearm. Just before he hit the ground, another gunshot cracked through the passage. He did not feel an impact, assumed the operator behind had aimed at his back but missed due to his leap to the ground. Court slammed into the cold tile floor, slid forward, and lifted the third gunman's pistol. The man with the knife in his eye was on his knees now, dying but not yet dead, screaming bloody murder. Gentry rolled onto his back next to him and turned to fire back at the last enemy still in the fight. This man had half a chance to shoot but hesitated. Court was alongside his partner. The gray man, however, did not hesitate. From his prone position, he poured round after round between his splayed legs into the armed man and watched him spin and die. When Court was certain the only man alive was the hitman next to him with the knife in his eye, he placed the barrel of the gun to the wounded man's temple and pulled the trigger without hesitation. The American stood over the bodies of three men sprawled in the bright white corridor. Blood splatters stained the wall, and pools grew from the corpses at his feet. His ears rang, and his thigh wound stung and throbbed. They had compromised themselves back at the coffee shop. He'd pegged them as operators in just over 1 second as they came through the door, and he noticed the unmistakable flicker of recognition in the first man's face as he met Gentry's glance. After identifying the threat these three men posed, Court had watched them in the reflection of the handbill of the poetry reading, in the reflection of the cafe's windows, out on the street in the windshields of the few passing vehicles. In the stairway down to the metro, he sensed them closing. They closed further in the tunnel, and by the last turn before the trains, he knew the time had come to act. Court had been faster, better trained, colder-hearted, but as he stood over the three bodies, he knew good and goddamn well there was only one reason they were now slaughtered meat, and his racing pulse continued to pump blood through him. Dumb fucking luck. These assassins just decided to stop in for coffee before taking position outside of his hotel, and Court just happened to be at the cafe when they got there. Everything else just fell into place after that. Court was lucky. He knew it was good to be lucky, but he also knew his luck could turn in an instant. Luck was fleeting, arbitrary, fickle. Court scavenged the bodies quickly and without a shred of remorse. He knew the morning's first commuters would be rounding the corner either towards or away from the trains in moments. Less than 30 seconds after the last gunshot, the gray man had collected a checkmate CZ pistol and a small wad of euros and crowns. 1 minute after that, he was back at street level and wearing a canvas jacket taken from one of the men. The blood on his dark brown pants was concealed by the morning shower. Through the mist he walked, purposefully but without haste, towards a bus stop near the Charles Bridge. A slight limp in his gait, but nothing else differentiated him from the ever-increasing throngs of people on the street, each beginning their workday commute. Fitzroy had been offered a small room with a cot to rest, but he refused on principle. Instead, he dozed fitfully in the conference room in a high-backed executive chair. Around his slumped form, the tech moved from terminal to terminal, and Lloyd made call after call on his mobile. The security men stood both inside and outside the door throughout the night. Sir Donald awoke at 6:30 and was just sipping black coffee when the tech called across the room to Lloyd.
"Sir, the Albanians are not checking in."
Lloyd had been sitting in a chair across from Fitzroy, drinking coffee and staring at a map of Prague. He looked up at his men, shrugged his shoulders, and pursed his lips.
"Hard to do when you're dead."
The tech remained hopeful.
"We have no way of knowing."
Lloyd wasn't listening. He spoke mostly to himself.
"One down, 11 to go. That didn't take long."
Fitzroy smiled behind his coffee cup, and Lloyd noticed this. He rose to his feet, circled the mahogany table, and kneeled in front of Sir Donald. In a soft voice, he said, "You and I may seem like adversaries, but we have the same goal here. If you are secretly celebrating the Gray Man's victory, remember that, as he gets closer to his target, the stakes will rise. The quicker he is put in the dirt, the better it is for you, your son, your daughter-in-law, and your precious little granddaughters." Sir Donald's smile faded. Over an hour later, Fitzroy's satellite phone chirped. Lloyd and his men immediately went into silent mode. Sir Donald pushed the speakerphone button just after the third ring.
"Court, I have been trying to reach you. How are you?"
"What the hell is going on?"
"What do you mean?"
"Another kill squad just tried to zap me."
"You're joking."
"Do I joke?"
"Admittedly not. Who were they?"
"I'm pretty fucking sure they were not Nigerians. Three white dudes, looked Central European. Didn't have time to pull IDs. If they were any good, they wouldn't have been carrying them anyway."
"Abu Bakr must still be using hired hands. No surprise, considering his deep pockets. Are you injured in any way?"
"Yeah, I am, but not by these clowns. I took a bullet to my thigh in the plane yesterday morning."
"You've been shot."
"No big deal." Lloyd reached quickly for a notepad and jotted this information down.
"Son, there has been a complication."
"Complication? I've had to take down 8 guys in the last 28 hours because of some breach in your network. You're damn right there's been a complication."
"The Nigerians know I am your handler."
The satellite connection went quiet for a moment. Finally, Gentry said,
"Shit, Don. How did that happen?"
"Like I said, a complication."
"Then you are in just as much danger as me. It's just a matter of time before they come for you, too." There was concern in the younger man's voice.
"They already have."
A pause.
"What's happened?"
"They have my family. My son and my daughter-in-law. My 2 grandchildren."
"The twins,"
Court said softly.
"Yes. They're holding them in France, telling me I must give you up, or they will kill them. 30 minutes ago, they gave me 48 hours to produce you, dead or alive. They have teams hunting for you, but they want me to give them intel on your whereabouts."
"Which you already have, apparently."
"No, son, I haven't said a word. You were compromised in Iraq somehow, yes, but a Nigerian agent saw you board the plane in Tbilisi. I told them nothing, and I don't intend to."
"But your son's family."
"I don't turn on my men. You are family too."
Fitzroy's face was twisted into a pained expression of disgust at his words, but Lloyd's eyes widened appreciatively at the elder gentleman's two-faced ability to simultaneously cajole and betray his top killer. Fitzroy was playing whatever remaining heartstrings his assassin possessed like a virtuoso. Lloyd knew Gentry's file like the back of his hand. He knew what would come next.
"Where are they holding them?"
"A chateau in Normandy, France, north of the town of Bayeux."
48 hours?
"Minus 30 minutes. 8 a.m. on Sunday morning is the deadline. They say they have assets in the French National Police. Any hint of an operation against their location will result in a massacre."
"Yeah, the cops will be useless.
I've got a better chance going solo."
"Court, I don't know what you're thinking, but it is too dangerous for you to try any sort of..."
"Don, I need you to trust me. Best thing I can do is get there and clean this shit up myself. I need you to get me all the intel you can about their force structure. Don't give up any info on me. And I will get your family back."
"How?"
"Somehow."
This time it was Sir Donald's turn to pause. He rubbed his thick fingers in his eyes and said slowly,
"I would be forever in your debt, lad."
"One thing at a time, boss."
The line went dead. Lloyd punched his fists into the air in victory. Fitzroy turned to Lloyd and said,
I'll get you the scalp you're after. But you have to adhere to your end of the bargain.
Sir Donald, nothing will make me happier than calling off my men and leaving you and your family alone.
Chapter 11. Cord Gentry had worked as a private operator for 4 years. Before that was Gulf Sierra, a.k.a. the Goon Squad, and previous to this, he ran singleton ops for the CIA. A few steely-eyed agency operatives notwithstanding, Gentry had spent the majority of his adult life alone. To be sure, when he was in deep cover, he developed the relationships necessary to conduct his missions, but these interactions were fleeting and based on a bed of lies. His was a life lived out in the cold. There had been but one episode in the last 16 years when Cort was not an assassin, not a spy, not a shadowy figure moving into and out of the landscape. 2 years earlier, for just under 2 months, Fitzroy had employed the Gray Man in a capacity completely unique to anything else on his resume. Cort took a post in close personal protection, bodyguard work, to watch over Sir Donald's 2 granddaughters. Their father, Sir Donald's son, was a successful London real estate developer. He did not follow in his father's footsteps into the shadowy realm of intelligence. He was an honest businessman, played by the rules. Still, Philip Fitzroy managed to run afoul of some Pakistani underworld types, something to do with his firm's lobbying against a municipal proposal that would have allowed more uncertified and unqualified labor on his construction sites. Philip Fitzroy logically argued that it was best for everyone in London if only well-trained workers built apartment dwellings and shopping centers. But the Pakistani mob had been extorting from the undocumented populace for years, and they decided that if more immigrants had higher-paying jobs, they could squeeze out from them a few quid more. It began with threatening phone calls. Philip was to back off, quit the lobbying campaign. A fake pipe bomb in the mailbox was found by Elise Fitzroy, Philip's wife. Scotland Yard opened an investigation. Dour-faced detectives rubbed their chins and promised to be vigilant. Philip continued his fight against the labor law. More threats came, and the Yard put a car with a narcoleptic officer in front of their Sussex Gardens townhome. Elise was cleaning out 6-year-old Kate's school backpack one afternoon while the girls watched television. She pulled a folded page out of an outside pouch, thinking it to be a note sent home from Mrs. Beasley. She opened it. Handwritten scrabble, large capital letters. "Any time we want them, we can have them. Lay off, Phil." Elise hysterically called Philip. Philip called Sir Donald no less frantic, and 7 hours later, Sir Donald arrived at the door with an American in tow. The Yank was neither big nor small. He was quiet, and he made little eye contact. Elise thought he was in his late 20s. Phil put him near 40. He wore jeans and a small backpack that never left his shoulder, and an oversized sweater under which, Philip assumed, was stashed God knows what manner of obscene apparatus for doing harm to his fellow man. Sir Donald sat with Elise and Philip in the drawing room while the man waited in the hall. He explained to the worried parents that this man's name was Jim, just Jim, and he was quite possibly the best in the world at that which he did.
"What exactly is that, Dad?" asked Philip. "Let's just say you're better off with him than you'd be were your whole street lined with cars filled to bursting with bobbies. That's no exaggeration."
"Doesn't look like much, Dad."
"That's part of the job. He's low profile."
"What the bloody hell do we do with him, Dad?"
"Throw him a sandwich a couple of times a day. Keep the coffee pot hot in the kitchen, and forget he's here."
But Elise refused to treat the man as an inanimate object. She was polite and found him to respond in kind. He never looked at her. This she insisted when her husband asked.
"He looks out the window to the street, out the window to the back garden, out the door to the twins' room. Never at me. You and he have that in common, Philip. You should get on brilliantly."
The introduction of an additional man to the Fitzroy household inevitably caused friction between husband and wife. Claire and Kate took to Jim. They mimicked his American accent, and he was good-natured about it. He drove them to school each day in the Saab while Elise rode along. Young Kate teased him once about being a bad driver, and he surprised mother and daughters with a burst of laughter, admitting he usually traveled by trains or rode a motorcycle. Within a second, his face re-hardened, and his eyes returned to the mirrors and the road ahead. For almost 2 months he was at the girls' sides every moment they were awake, and he was on a cot in the hallway by their door while they slept. The only moment of excitement in the 8 weeks came one Sunday on the way to the market when a car accident blocked the road. As soon as traffic stopped, Jim bumped the car up onto the pavement. He opened his sport coat, and Elise saw the butt of a handgun nestled under his arm. He drove down the pavement with his left hand through a scrambling crowd, while his right hand curled around the pistol in its shoulder holster. 10 seconds later, they were in the clear. He said not a word to the passengers, like it was just another normal Sunday jaunt out for milk and cakes. Mum and her girls stared at him wide-eyed for the rest of the drive. And then, one morning, he was gone. The quilt was left folded on the cot, the pillow laid on top. It was in the papers that the Pakistani mobsters had been arrested by the dour-faced men at Scotland Yard. The danger had passed, and Sir Donald had sent his yank away. Philip and Elise breathed an incredible sigh of relief that the threat was no more, and the ridiculous law had been defeated. But the little girls cried when their father told them Uncle Jim had to go back to America, and no, he was not likely to return. Court bought a motorcycle less than an hour after he closed his call with Fitzroy. It was an 86 Honda CM450 with a decent enough engine and tires that looked like they could make it for a few days of heavy use. The seller was a local boy who worked at a petrol station alongside the road in Seberov, just southeast of Prague. No paperwork, just a cash transaction, a few hundred crowns extra for a helmet and a map, and Court was on the road. He hadn't hesitated a moment since hanging up the phone with Don. Court knew there was a day or so of travel ahead of him if he was to go to Normandy. He could work on a plan while on the road and check in with Fitzroy en route. No, there was no time to sit on a park bench here, 600 miles away, and contemplate. After buying the bike, he stopped at his cache in a long-term rental unit 4 miles south of the city center. He no longer had a key for the door, so he merely picked the lock. He could recite the credit card number used to pay the monthly rent if he had been questioned, but in fact, there was no one around. He'd established the cache nearly 3 years earlier, had only been back once, and now the small, unlit room was dusty and moldy and cold. It was 8 feet square, empty except for 4 duffel bags stacked one on top of the other, each wrapped in a white garbage bag covered in dust. The cache contained pistols, rifles, ammo, clothing, and vacuum-packed food and medical supplies. He tossed the CZ he'd picked up in the gunfight in the metro into one of the bags and retrieved a small Walther P99 compact pistol and 2 extra magazines. The weapon was clean and well-lubricated, but still he checked the ammunition and the operation of the slide and the striker. He ignored the rest of his guns. He knew he could hardly cross the border into the European Union with an arsenal on his back. The handgun would just have to do. Next, he ripped open a medical kit, dropped his pants, and sat on the cold, dirty floor. The scratching of a rat in the aluminum walls let him know just how unsanitary these conditions were. He examined his day-old injury with a professional fascination. Court had never before been shot, but he'd picked up dozens of other injuries in his work. His leg throbbed like a bitch, but he'd been hurt worse from burns, broken bones, a chunk of shrapnel in his neck. It came with the job. He poured a generous splash of iodine on the entrance and exit wounds. He tore open packages of bandages and antiseptic cream, redressed his injury as well as possible in the low light, and then crumpled all his supplies back into a small bag and shoved it into his pocket. In his second duffel, he found cold weather gear. He changed out of his light clothing into thick corduroys, a grease-stained brown cotton shirt, and a thick canvas jacket. A pair of work gloves went on his hands, and they warmed his fingers instantly. Leather hiking boots. A black watch cap that could be pulled down as a ski mask was positioned on his head. He zipped up all his cases, left them as he'd found them, closed the door, and climbed back on his bike. Minutes later, he found himself at a crossroads south of the city. A few hours west was the German border, then the French border, then Normandy. He blew out a sigh masked by his engine's rumble. Steam from his exhalation poured through the microfiber ski mask covering his mouth. If it were only that easy. No, he had to make a few crucial pit stops along the way. Gentry needed to pick up some materiel before he arrived in Normandy. He knew where to get what he needed, but he also knew it would involve an extra half day on the road. For one, Cort needed a new escape, new forged identity papers. He still had the passport he'd used to get into the Czech Republic, and he knew it would get him around in Central Europe, where they did not have all their immigration processes computerized and integrated, but he'd already been burned once under the legend Martin Baldwin, Canadian freelance journalist. Only a hopeless optimist or a damn fool would try to use it to get into the European Union, and Gentry was neither. But more than entree to the EU, he needed an escape solid enough to get him out of Europe when the shooting stopped. He knew that after he did what he had to do in Normandy, he would need to disappear somewhere far away, and clean identity papers would be the easiest way to achieve this end. Cort knew a man in Hungary who could provide him with documentation quickly. With well-made docs, he could cross quickly and efficiently into the EU and, should he have to produce papers for any reason along the way, he could safely do so. And then, once he'd finished his operation, he'd be able to dump all his guns and gear, hop on a plane to South America or the South Pacific or fucking Antarctica if the heat on him remained as hot as it had been the last 2 days. There'd be no time to run around and buy dirty docks after Normandy, and no way to quickly get off the continent without them. A cold November wind blew from the west as Gentry turned onto the E-65, the highway that would take him past Brno, into Slovakia, around Bratislava, and then south to the Hungarian border. From there, it would be a quick trip down to Budapest. 6 hours travel time, factoring in a couple of quick stops for gas and two poorly guarded borders. As he opened the throttle and leaned into the cold wind, he forced himself to think about the next 48 hours. It was grim contemplation, but necessary, and a hell of a lot better than dwelling on the past 48. Chapter 12. Gentry entered the capital of Hungary at 3 in the afternoon. Rain clouds hung low and gray-white, just tickling the rounded green tips of the hills of Buda on the west side of the Danube River that bisected the city of 4 million. Cort had last visited Budapest 4 years earlier on his first job for Fitzroy, a simple domestic op against a Siberian hitman who'd put a bomb in a local restaurant to kill a mob gunrunner, but in so doing also took out an American man's brother. The surviving brother had money and ties to the underworld, so it was a simple thing for him to connect with Fitzroy and hire a trigger man. And it was a simple thing for Fitzroy to send his newest asset to Budapest to find the offending Serb in a dockside bar, fill him with drink, then slip a knife into his spine and let his lifeless form slip silently into the black waters of the Danube. Gentry also knew Budapest from before, back in his time with the agency. He'd been in and out of the city once every couple of years for nearly a decade, tailing diplomats, running sneak and peeks against shady Russian businessmen in the mansions of Buda or the hotels in Pest. He'd once chased off a Tajik assassin, targeting the local CIA chief of station because there was no one else handy to deal with the matter. In Cort's work in the city, he'd had multiple run-ins with a local fraudster named Laszlo Szabó. Szabó was an amoral, devious scumbag. He'd do anything for anyone, waving a big enough wad of crumpled Hungarian forints in his face. His specialty was forgery, buying and selling identity papers and modifying them for whoever needed their identity changed on the fly. He'd helped a dozen wanted Serb war criminals flee Central Europe just ahead of the International Court of Justice, and had made a shitload of money cleaning up the dirty loose ends of that war and others. Then, in 2004, he ran afoul of Gentry himself when he agreed to create papers for a Chechen terrorist who'd slipped out of Grozny and the Russians' grasp and into Budapest on his way farther west. Court and his goon squad caught up with the Chechen in a warehouse Laszlo owned in the suburbs. It had gone loud, and in the melee, a tub of Sabo's photographic chemicals had blown up, killing the terrorist. Court and his team had to disappear before the fire trucks arrived, leaving Laszlo to slip away. Immediately thereafter, Court was sent after bigger fish, but he remembered Sabo, kept tabs on the forger, just in case someday he needed his services. Court normally used documentation assets from Sir Donald Fitzroy's network, but it was nice to know there was also a man in Budapest who could, for the right price, turn him into anyone he wanted to be, at least on paper. Laszlo Sabo was an irredeemable piece of shit. Court knew this beyond a shadow of a doubt, but Court also knew Sabo was damn good at his work. It was 3:30 by the time Court had filled his gas tank, bought a gyro and lemonade at a little Turkish stand on Andrashi Street, and parked his bike a block away from Laszlo's lair in Pest, just a kilometer or so from the shores of the Danube. Icy sheets of cold rain poured down, but Gentry did nothing to shield himself from the weather. His muscles were tiring from the already long day. The rain soaked his hair and his beard and his clothes, but it also kept him alert. The door to Laszlo's building was a deception. A rusty iron plate on hinges sunken in a stone building on Etvos Utka Street. It was covered with yellowed and torn handbills and stood no more than 5 feet high. It looked like no one had passed through since the Second World War, but Court had just finished his soggy meal of lamb chunks and cucumber sauce folded into a pita when the door creaked open and disgorged two thin black men. Somalis, Court guessed. In Europe, illegally, obviously, since no one who had access to legitimate papers would have need to come see Laszlo. Court knew how easy it was for Africans and Middle Easterners to immigrate legally to the continent these days. These two knuckleheads walking past him in the rain somehow didn't qualify for the near-universal rubber stamp entry, which indicated to Gentry that these were some seriously shady fuckers. In a moment of perspective, the gray man realized there were few people on Earth more wanted than he, so Court allowed he was, by definition, likely a shadier fucker than either of these two Somalis. Gentry banged on the little iron door with an open left hand. His right hovered above the Walther pistol in his waistband and hidden under his wet jacket. There was no answer after a minute and a further knock. Finally, Court found a little plastic intercom button tucked into the upper left corner of the doorway.
Sabo, I need your help. I can pay.
A tinny response through the intercom.
References?
His accent was unmistakably Hungarian, but his English was good. The tone of his voice was sheer boredom. A clerk in a paint store. Court was just the next of a long line of customers reaching the counter to inquire about goods.
I'm one of Donald Fitzroy's men.
Though Sabo was not a network asset, he would certainly know of Sir Donald. A pause, just long enough for Court to worry, ended with a buzz and the sound of remote-controlled door locks clicking open. Court pushed in the iron door warily, knelt, and entered a dark hall behind it, followed a pinprick of light 50 feet on. The light was another doorway, and through it, Court found a large workshop, part science lab, part library, and part photo studio. Laszlo was there, sitting at a desk against the wall. He turned to face his visitor. Sabo wore his gray hair long over his shoulders. His clothes were Hungarian drab, black jeans, and a polyester shirt open halfway down to expose his rail-thin chest. He was 60, but an East Bloc 60, which looked 80 in the face but 30 in the physique. a life of physicality, a life of hardship. He appeared to Court something like an aging rock star who still fancied himself a catch. He stared at Court for a long time.
"A familiar face," he said. "Without the beard and the rainwater, perhaps I would know you?"
Court knew Sabot had never seen his face.